Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling two really central Christian doctrines that can feel like real brain twisters. The divine incarnation and the Trinity.
Yeah.
If you've ever thought, how can God be human or, you know, wait, three gods in one, you're definitely in good company.
Oh, absolutely. Even the early church wrestled with these exact concepts for, well, a century.
Right. It wasn't straightforward.
Not at all. Trying to understand how these core beliefs fit together, both biblically and like logically, has been this continuous journey for theologians and thinkers. And it's a journey that's still really relevant today.
And that's basically what we're here to do. We've got a fantastic resource in Dr. Jim Spiegel's Philosophy of Religion lecture. And we're going to dig into these doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
We want to do it in a way that's philosophically informed, sure.
Yeah.
But also really clear and helpful for you.
Yeah. Break it down a bit.
Exactly. Our aim is that by the end of this deep dive, you'll feel much more confident in grasping the key distinctions and to maybe have some of those nagging questions addressed.
Oh.
So let's dive straight in. Divine incarnation first.
Sounds good. Okay, so at its heart, the divine incarnation is the belief that Jesus Christ is one single person.
One person.
Who has two natures. He's fully human and fully God. Now, the immediate question that probably pops into your head, and it's a big one, is how? How can someone truly be both of those things at the same time?
Yeah, it really does feel like a contradiction, doesn't it?
It can, absolutely.
They're trying to square a circle or something.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where some really insightful thinking comes in. Dr. Spiegel references the work of Thomas Morris, especially his book, The Logic of God Incarnate.
Yes, Morris. Very important work on this.
It sounds like a fascinating read if you want to go deeper. And what's interesting, Spiegel points out Morris, with his strong philosophical background,
right.
He later moved into business ethics,
mm-hmm.
wrote a book called If Aristotle Ran General Motors.
He did. Talk about applying philosophy in different fields. But that philosophical grounding is definitely key here.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Spiegel highlights an essential first step in navigating this whole thing. Understanding the difference between a contradiction, a paradox, and a mystery.
Okay, let's break those down.
Right. So a contradiction is basically saying X is true and X is not true in the exact same way at the same time. Impossible.
Like A and not A.
Exactly. A paradox, though, is something that looks contradictory on the surface, but when you dig deeper, it actually isn't. It just seems that way initially.
Okay.
And then a mystery is simply a truth that's, well, beyond our complete human understanding. It might involve a paradox, it might not, but we just can't fully grasp it.
That's a really helpful framework. So something can be mysterious without being strictly illogical.
Precisely. And Morris, as Dr. Spiegel explains, offers a really useful distinction to apply here. Individual essence versus kind essence.
Okay, individual essence and kind essence. Let's unpack that. Individual essence is basically all the unique properties that make a particular thing what it is.
Yeah, think of it like your specific fingerprint plus everything else that makes you uniquely you. All your qualities, your history, everything.
The whole package.
The whole package. That's individual essence.
Okay, now kind essence is different. That's the set of properties that are absolutely necessary and sufficient for something to belong to a specific category or kind.
Exactly. Like, what must something have to be a human? Or what must something have to be a cat? Spiegel uses the example of mammals needing lungs. That's part of the kind essence of being a mammal.
Right. So for humans, things like having a rational mind, the capacity for emotions.
Yeah.
Those core things.
Those are the essential defining characteristics. And here's where it gets really interesting when we apply this to Jesus. The traditional Christian belief, which Morris's work supports, is that Jesus's individual essence.
His unique Jesusness.
Right. His unique Jesusness included both a complete humankind essence and a complete divine kind essence.
Okay, hold on. So whatever the core non-negotiable properties are for being human, having a human body,
yeah.
a human mind, feeling joy, sorrow, all that.
Yeah.
Jesus had all of those. But at the same time, he also possessed all the essential properties of being divine, like omnipotence, omniscience, perfect goodness.
That's the idea. His individual existence uniquely combined these two complete sets of essential properties, these two kind essences. Now, Dr. Spiegel brings up a common question that you might be pondering right now. Didn't Jesus lack some properties that seem pretty fundamental to being human? Like, he wasn't conceived through a human father in the usual biological way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That seems like a pretty major difference from you know, everyone else.
It does seem like it. But Dr. Spiegel introduces another helpful distinction here. Common properties versus essential properties.
Okay, common versus essential.
Common properties are those things that many or even most members of a group have. Like Spiegel jokes, most humans have two hands or a belly button.
Right. Typical characteristics, but maybe not absolutely necessary to define the category.
Exactly. Whereas essential properties are the ones you absolutely must have to be a member of that group. Mm. Like we said, having a mind seems pretty essential to being human.
Sure. You could tragically lose a hand, but you'd still be fully human because having two hands is common, not essential.
Right. And this distinction is key to answering that question about Jesus's conception. Dr. Spiegel argues that not being conceived by a human father is an uncommon property, but it's not an essential one for being human.
How so?
Well, think about it. If you take the Genesis creation story literally, as Spiegel points out, the first humans, Adam and Eve,
all right,
they wouldn't have had human parents at all. Were they any less human because of that unique origin?
That's a really interesting point. And Spiegel even mentions the rare case of people born without a navel. It's definitely uncommon, but it doesn't make them not human.
Exactly. So the unique nature of Jesus's conception is presented as uncommon, maybe, but not violating the essential properties of humanity.
Okay. But what about the other side of the coin? How could Jesus be genuinely, truly human if he had these clearly divine abilities, you know, walking on water, reading minds? Mm. Wouldn't that make him more than human?
Right. Doesn't it disqualify him from the human category? This leads us to another crucial distinction. Being merely human versus being fully human.
Merely human versus fully human. Okay.
Dr. Spiegel explains that to be fully human, you just need to possess all the essential properties of humanity. The argument is that Jesus did exactly that. Human mind, body, emotions, etc.
He ticked all the essential boxes for human.
But because he also possessed divine properties, he wasn't merely human in the sense of being limited to only human attributes. He was, as Spiegel puts it,
human plus divine.
Human plus divine, or human plus infinity, as he jokes.
Yeah, that kind of captures it. So the argument is, as long as there isn't a fundamental clash, like a logical contradiction, between the essential human properties Jesus had and the divine properties he also possessed,
then the view can hold.
Then this understanding is coherent. And Dr. Spiegel points out that, well, no one has successfully demonstrated such a definitive contradiction.
The real challenges, though, often pop up when we look at specific moments in the Bible. Like, take Jesus' statement in Matthew 24. He says he doesn't know the exact time of his return.
Right. That's a big one. Doesn't that suggest a limitation in knowledge? A lack of omniscience? And isn't omniscience a core attribute of divinity?
It's a tough one, yeah. A real sticking point for many people. Dr. Spiegel brings up the kenosis view, kenosis, from the Greek for emptying.
Okay.
This suggests that Jesus willingly gave up, or like limited the use of some of his divine attributes, maybe including omniscience, during his time on earth.
Hmm. But as the Dr. Spiegel also notes, doesn't that raise serious questions about whether he remained fully God if he set aside such fundamental divine aspects?
Exactly. It feels like you might be diminishing his divinity to explain his human limitations. It's a tricky balance.
So what's the alternative? Morris, according to Spiegel, leans towards something called the two minds view.
Right. The idea here is that Jesus had both a divine mind, which was fully aware of everything, omniscient, and a human mind that perhaps didn't always have conscious access to all that divine knowledge.
Okay, so like two consciousnesses. Spiegel uses analogies, right?
Yeah.
Like conscious and unconscious minds.
Yeah, or like computer hardware versus the software running on it. The human mind is like the software, maybe not accessing everything stored in the divine hardware, so to speak.
It's interesting. An attempt to keep both full divinity and genuine human limitation within one person.
It is. But as Dr. Spiegel readily acknowledges, this two minds view isn't without its own philosophical hurdles.
Yeah, I could see that.
The big one is, how can someone with what sound like two distinct minds truly be considered a single unified person? Doesn't that lean towards like two persons in one body?
Right. It feels like it could fracture the unity of Christ's personhood. Spiegel also mentions another possibility, doesn't he?
He does. Just the idea that Jesus, even if he had access to that knowledge in his divine consciousness, might have simply chosen not to access or reveal it in his human consciousness for a specific purpose related to his mission.
So less about two minds and more about of voluntary non-accessing of information.
Kind of, yeah. Emphasizing a deliberate choice rather than an inherent structural limitation, maybe?
Okay. So, wrapping up the incarnation part, Dr. Spiegel's conclusion seems to be that while it presents profound philosophical challenges, deep mysteries.
Definitely mysteries.
It doesn't necessarily have to be seen as a logical impossibility, like a flat-out contradiction. It's at least a mystery, maybe a paradox, but not necessarily A and not A.
That seems to be the takeaway. The distinctions help show it's not demonstrably incoherent, even if it remains mind-bending.
Okay, wow. We've covered a lot of ground there. Now, let's shift gears slightly, but stay with these core theological ideas. Let's turn to the Trinity.
Right. Another foundational doctrine, the Orthodox Christian understanding, as Dr. Spiegel outlines, is that God is triune, meaning one God.
One God.
Existing in three co-equal, co-eternal persons. The Father, the Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit.
And this belief, as Spiegel points out, isn't just spelled out in one single verse like God is a Trinity, right?
Yeah.
It's more inferred.
Exactly. It's understood to be inferred from various passages throughout the Bible. Spiegel mentions places where the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are all individually referred to as God.
And the Great Commission in Matthew 28, that's a key one. Jesus tells his followers to baptize in the name, singular.
Singular name, yeah. Very significant.
The Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. It suggests the unity encompassing the three.
It does. And Spiegel even looks back to the Old Testament, mentioning the primary Hebrew word for God, Elohim.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually plural in form. While it's usually used with singular verbs, suggesting one God, the plural form itself is seen by some as potentially hinting at a plurality within the Godhead, even though the full doctrine really develops in the New Testament.
Interesting hint there. But okay, from a philosophical standpoint, the immediate question for you, the listener, is probably, how can God be both three and one at the same time? That sounds like one eats three, three.
It really does sound like a mathematical impossibility. But as Dr. Spiegel is quick to clarify, the doctrine isn't claiming God is three in one in the exact same respect.
Okay, that's crucial. It's not three beings equals one being or three persons equals one person.
No. The core of the doctrine is that God is one being, or you could say one divine substance or essence.
One what?
One what, exactly. But this one God exists as three distinct persons. So the one refers to his fundamental nature, the divine essence, while the three refers to the distinct personal ways this one God exists and relates Father, Son, Spirit.
So one what being essence and three whose persons.
That's a good way to put it. And this distinction is really important, especially as Spiegel notes, when addressing a common misunderstanding, sometimes raised by those of other faiths, that Christians believe in three gods.
Right. The charge of polytheism.
Precisely. But by understanding it's one God in three persons, we see it's not polytheism. It's a much more complex understanding of the inner life and nature of the one God. Monotheism, but a very specific kind.
Okay. Now, another question that often comes up related to the incarnation discussion, too.
Yeah.
If Jesus is the Son of God, how can he be fully one with God if God created him? Doesn't creation imply a separation, a beginning, making the created thing distinct from and maybe less than the creator?
That's a very common and understandable question. Dr. Spiegel addresses this by explaining that, according to Orthodox Christian theology, the Son, Jesus, was not created by the Father.
Not created.
No. The term used is eternally begotten.
Begotten. Okay, what does that mean here?
Spiegel uses a helpful analogy to human families. When humans beget children, we're not creating entirely new kinds of beings from scratch, right? We're passing on the same human nature.
Ah, okay. My kids share my fundamental humanness. They weren't just, like, invented out of thin air.
Exactly. And Dr. Spiegel draws a parallel here, albeit imperfectly, with the Trinity. The Son eternally proceeds from, or is begotten by, the Father. And the Holy Spirit eternally proceeds from the Father and the Son, in Western theology, at least.
So begotten and proceeding describe eternal relationships within the Godhead.
Yes. Not acts of creation that would imply a lesser status or a beginning in time for the Son or the Spirit. Each person, Father, Son, Spirit, is fully divine, fully sharing in that one divine essence or being.
Okay, that's a critical clarification. Begotten, not made, as the creed says.
Exactly. Now, Dr. Spiegel then points out two common pitfalls, two ancient heresies, really, that people fall into when trying to simplify the Trinity. It's easy to go wrong here.
What is?
The first is modalism. This basically says that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit aren't distinct persons at all, but just different ways the one God shows himself, different modes or masks he wears at different times, like water being ice, liquid, and steam.
Okay, so one actor playing three roles.
Kind of. The problem with modalism, Spiegel notes, is that it doesn't really account for the genuine distinctness and, importantly, the personal relationships we see between the Father, Son, and Spirit in the Bible. Think of Jesus praying to the Father. If they're just modes of the same person, who is he talking to?
Right. That interaction seems to require real distinctness. Spiegel mentions some Pentecostal views sometimes lean this way.
He mentions that historically some interpretations, particularly within certain oneness Pentecostal traditions, have been understood as essentially modalistic, though it's complex.
Okay. And the other extreme?
That's tritheism, which, as the name suggests, goes too far the other way and essentially views the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit as three completely separate divine beings, three distinct gods.
Which is just straight up polytheism.
Exactly. And that's fundamentally counter to Christian teaching, which is firmly monotheistic. So the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity is this careful balancing act.
Holding unity and distinctness together.
Yes, emphasizing both the fundamental unity of God's being, one God, and the real distinctness of the three persons, Father, Son, Spirit, within that one being. It's about avoiding collapse into either modalism, too much unity, losing distinctness, or tritheism, too much distinctness, losing unity.
Okay, that's the tightrope walk. Now, to help us get a clearer philosophical handle on how we even talk about this without contradicting ourselves, Dr. Spiegel introduces a really insightful linguistic distinction.
Ah, yes, this is super helpful.
The difference between the is of identity and the is of predication. Sounds technical, but let's break it down.
It's actually quite practical. It's about how we use the word is. The is of identity means that two things are literally one and the same thing, A, B.
Spiegel uses the example of Jocasta as Oedipus's mother.
Right. A rather dramatically revealed identity, as he notes, in that statement, is, signifies identity. The person Jocasta and the person who is Oedipus's mother are one and the same individual.
Okay, is means equals. What's the other one?
The is of predication. This is when we use is to describe a quality, a property, or a characteristic that something possesses, like saying Jocasta is blonde.
Okay. You're not saying Jocasta equals the abstract concept of blondness.
Exactly. You're saying she has the characteristic of being blonde. You're predicating blondness of Jocasta.
Got it. So how does this help with the Trinity? It seems like we say the Father is God, the Son is God, the Spirit is God, but also the Father is not the Son. How does that work?
Okay, here's the key application. When we say the Father is God, the Son is God, and the Holy Spirit is God, the is in these statements is the is of predication.
Predication. So we're saying each person has the characteristic of being divine.
Precisely. We're saying the Father possesses the full attributes of divinity, the Son possesses the full attributes of divinity, and the Holy Spirit possesses the full attributes of divinity. They all share the same divine nature or essence.
But when we say the Father is not the Son, we're using the is or is not of identity.
Exactly. We're saying they are not the same person. They are distinct persons within the one Godhead. So the Father is predication God. The Son is predication God. The Spirit is predication God. But the Father is not identity of the Son. The Son is not identity of the Spirit, etc.
Wow. Okay, that distinction really helps clarify the language. It allows you to affirm both the divinity of each person and their distinctness without formal contradiction.
It's a crucial tool for articulating the orthodox view. One God in being essence existing as three distinct, co-equal, and eternally related persons.
Okay, this has genuinely been a deep dive. We've unpacked some complex but absolute foundational Christian ideas.
We really have.
We explored the divine incarnation, looking at those key distinctions. Individual versus kind essence.
Mm-hmm.
Common versus essential properties. And that difference between being merely human and fully human. Plus, grappling with the challenge of Jesus' knowledge.
And then we shifted to the Trinity, stressing the core belief one God in three persons. We clarified begotten versus created, warned against the heresies of modalism and tritheism, and used that philosophical tool, the is of identity versus predication, to make sense of Trinitarian language.
So the takeaway seems to be that while these doctrines, incarnation and Trinity, will likely always contain an element of profound mystery.
For sure, things beyond our full grasp.
The distinctions we've discussed, drawn largely from Dr. Spiegel's lecture and the thinkers he engages with, like Morris, they really do provide a framework, a way to understand these beliefs that addresses many of the immediate worries about logical incoherence or contradiction.
Absolutely. It shows that careful thought has gone into this over centuries. By considering the language precisely and looking at these different facets, we can move beyond maybe simplistic objections and engage more deeply with the profound claims these doctrines are making about the nature of God and reality.
Definitely food for thought. And on that note, here's maybe a final thought for you, our listener, to mull over. Reflect on what it might mean to believe in a God who is understood to be both so intimately human through the person of Jesus in the Incarnation, and yet also infinitely divine and complex as the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. How might the very concept of person or personhood differ when we apply it within the Trinity compared to how we understand ourselves as human persons? It's a fascinating thing to ponder that interplay of unity and diversity within God Himself, and perhaps even how that might shed light on the unity and diversity we see in your own life, in human relationships, and in the world around you.
A lot to think about there.
Definitely. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.